Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And I've got a new one for you, other than it is an hour lever. Since we wrapped up the notes on the Constitutional Convention by James Madison and the next step. Okay, so if you look at the logical process of what we're trying to do in the Constitution and in this educational show, trying to give you all of the source documents, what did the framers say throughout these processes from the Tory Acts, the beginning of the Revolution, when what did the Englishmen in their known government and under their known rights, what did they do? They organized themselves into committees of safety, assemblies, councils, what have you, right? And so we kind of showed you the very beginning of what they did under the British monarchy of how to exert their rights. Now, these are rights that were protected by the Magna Carta and the Bill of Rights. Then we perceived, you know, they pursued forward, realizing that the British Crown and Parliament was going to be deaf to acknowledging that, one, these men were Englishmen or the colonies, and the people there were English people of the Britain Empire. And, you know, as we read the Articles of Association, it was very clear that they were very proud. They felt that they were the most loyal British subjects. They acknowledged themselves as subjects. Now, I'm saying these things because I want you to understand that they knew what government was. We hear people today saying, no, you're just an inhabitant, you're not a citizen. I mean, we're hearing all of these really contrary things. In other words, these conservatives of the sovereign citizen movement, the rest of these people, they want you to believe that you're really not a citizen of any government. You know, check out, get out of this thing, because you don't have to be. Now, the facts are that when Congress went through and defined what a citizen was in the very beginning, or before the turn of the 18th, hundreds or the 19th century, going from the 18th to the 19th. So in the 1790s, they had a few acts. One was the naturalized or the natural born citizen. That I believe was in 1790. And they also dove into the citizenship. So we kind of given you all of these types of documents, kind of covered these over the history of the show. But bottom line, within these definitions of what a citizen is, what is an immigrant? What is an inhabitant? So the fact that there were inhabitants, as a matter of fact, technically, the Indians were inhabitants. Okay? The Indians were inhabitants, and they claimed to be, and the mistake, and I think it was really more of a differences of religious perceptions, because when you look at the cultures are driven. I mean, they're driven and established based on these religious philosophies. That's why you saw the warring between the different tribes and the unique differences between the tribes. I mean, the Adobes or the Navajo were definitely a unique tribe out of the types of American Indians we had, or how they lived and their beliefs and practices. There were commonalities, but they still warred with each other. I mean, the civilized folks of the framers, those people who came even from other land, you know, they referred to that lifestyle and that culture as savages. Okay, so right, wrong, or different. I mean, these are all perceptions. It's subjective to the biases of the individuals. As a matter of fact, I'll jump down for a second here and say, everybody that writes, even yours truly, writes with a bias. I really try my best to stay on the side of academia, where I try to make less judgmental calls. But sometimes when when I actually find how things were violated, now these aren't necessarily a subjective call, how the courts violated the Constitution. No. To be clear, when you see me actually, speak either sarcastically or what have you, the conclusion is, and unless you can prove me wrong, I believe I'm absolutely right in basically stating that the courts are corrupt. The courts had violated the Constitution. These men, particularly Warren, Marshall, and many others, they made a choice. They made a choice to actually stretch, bend, and in today's definition, bore false witness, right? As a matter of fact, I've talked to people, what do we call a lie? A lie is it sometimes, politicized or what? The Bible calls it bearing false witness, because sometimes people may, they may tell a lie, but they may not know that it's actually a lie. But when somebody actually knows what they're saying, and a good case in point, we're all taught, and a lot of us in this society, because of our education system, we're lied to, where we think that this is the science, evolution is the science. And that's a big lie. But the people that say that, they don't believe they're lying. They really believe that that is the truth. And they've never challenged that. Now, when my challenges actually prove that they were lying, then I think I'm on the high ground in calling these men, corrupt people who were bearing false witness, because they knew the truth. I believe Warren, Chief Justice Warren, knew the truth. So, anyway, we're kind of doing a unique show because we're in the transition. So what we're going to do is we're going to start with Paul and I going through the ratification debates. And actually, let me see if I can pull those up, because I believe we're going to be starting with the, let me see here. Yeah, I've got it right here. So I believe we're starting with Pennsylvania. And so tomorrow we're going to start with Paul and I covering the things that are important. Then we're going to go through Massachusetts, and then we're going to go through Virginia, and we're going to go through North Carolina. When all of this is said and done, I'm actually going to pull out some things that we've never covered in, or really emphasizing. Let me just kind of speak a little more calmer. What I'm going to do after we go through the fundamentals, what we usually go through on a yearly basis, we're going to go through those. And then once we've done that, I am going to highlight parts that we have never read before. Because what I'm doing right now is I'm doing an initial scrub. And this is going to take me some time, because reading through the entire ratification debates and actually doing word searches, because, you got to zone in on a point in time where they're talking about subjects and going through our topics and going through and finding these points where they reference in one particular case how the king would be using arbitrary laws to oppress the people by keeping them from accessing the resources of the land. In other words, because the king owned land. Well, why is that important? Because the framers did not allow the federal government to own land other than those lands enumerated. Why is that important? Because it proves the point of the enumerations of the Constitution. If it is not in the Constitution, they cannot meddle with it, which is contrary to what we're being told at the bearing of false witness. because I need to use that instead of lying, because sometimes you don't know if they're, somewhere along the line, these people have just been educated on, the superstitions of, the power of government. Well, what we're dealing with is a complete superstition that the federal government has all these powers. It's a superstition. It's not proven. They may have the power. They've assumed the power, but it doesn't mean they actually have the power. I mean, when they've assumed it and they can use it and they can kill us and they can do those things, that doesn't make it legitimate. So this is why when we go through and scrub the ratification debates, I'm going to find and bring forth more fruit to help everybody understand. So what we're doing, and as I go through this, I've decided I'm going to use a 24 as an indicator that, you know, here it is in the navigation pane, you'll see a 24 dash. And so unlike last year, we just highlighted, and I had these little highlights. Some highlights that I'll reemphasize, because when I go through this point, some of the points we need to really emphasize is statehood. Why? Folks, because they started messing with state sovereignty very early on. We need to go through and define the type of land that they can possess and why standing armies, this, you know, some of these fundamental things that will absolutely decimate the lies that they have been telling or the bearing of false witnesses from the courts and those people who made these assertions that this be the gospel of the federal government and their powers. And I am here to tell you that the truth is unstoppable. When we're creating an argument based on the truth, then it cannot be put asunder. So when we left off, and so this is kind of like the tie-over on Feedback Friday. Even though it's Monday, it's a tie-over on what we're going to cover. Because, you know, there are all sorts of, and you've heard me talk about these frustrations, right? That there are all sorts of conservatives that are being misinformed. There are people that believe that the party, this is how, you know, the only path forward. And I'm just confirming that, I was just about to say that I'm right. And I would have broken my arm trying to pat myself on the back there, because I don't like being, you know, prideful, arrogant, or what have you. I am not wrong. You cannot prove me wrong that the only path forward is interposition, using petitions and getting the parties to the compacts to actually stand up and say, this is the compact. We never gave you those authorities. Some of these changes you made to the compact, you did not follow the proper process because you thought you could get away with assuming something from an unauthorized power from the federal government and so forth, like in the state constitutions. Many state constitutions were changed and altered because the federal government told us to do that. And the state legislatures just bowed to the tyranny from Mordor, and they just implemented these changes, such as getting rid of your county representation in your state senate. So anyway, what we ended up doing on Friday is we ended during the front end of this political exercise or exorcism that I was conducting in setting the record straight regarding the Constitution and some very significant amendments. Now, there are three, actually there's four, but I'm not even going to go into the 13th Amendment. I think the 13th Amendment stands for itself, and you will actually get your own chance to judge this. If you go to reclaimingtherepublic.org and you go to the Constitutional Articles page, go look for the Compiled Laws of the State of Wyoming. It's a book that was published by the Wyoming Territorial Government, I think Mr. Livingston, and you can read in that book what the 13th Amendment was. Because this is in the 1870s, folks. Go read the 13th Amendment. The 13th Amendment in that particular book, and here's the key here. I want you to understand that this book was published, and, you know, Wyoming was, you know, a stone's throw? No. They were days and days away from, you know, the rest of the culture, what was going on politically. I mean, when you're out in the wild, wild west, you have no idea what the heck's going on in the world. You know, you find out 5-10 years later that so-and-so was killed. So at the point of this document being written, the concept of the 14th Amendment was still being challenged, and there was all sorts of spinning, and I'll just say, because when you look at this, it does not include the 14th Amendment, but it actually includes, I believe, the 15th Amendment. So why did it not include the 14th Amendment? Because there's, in my eyes, I believe that they were doing every, because who was it that had basically started to stop the 14th Amendment in trying to keep it from being ratified? Well, first off, it was the Southern Democrats. Now, I ask you, do your own research and go look through the Supreme Court justices. If you look at Taney, I don't know if Taney was still alive at this time, but if you look at Taney himself, Taney was a huge embracer of slavery. That's why he ruled the way he did with the Dred Scott case. He just denied the fact that black men were actually voting. Black freemen, let me just make this clear, black freemen were voting prior to the Constitution and after the Revolutionary War, after the Constitution, and so forth. And the fact is, folks, is that there were a lot of people that have tried to cover up the 13th Amendment afterwards, because after the Bar Association was created, they realized that, you know, they actually shouldn't be able to hold, they shouldn't even be citizens when you read the 13th Amendment. Go read the original 13th Amendment that was ratified in 1812. And you can actually read it in this document, and you can actually go judge for yourselves. See, this is a source document that, in its own way, you could see how it was at least manipulated based on the messaging, because there was this contention swirling regarding the 14th Amendment. That's why we're diving into this today. But anyway, what I actually want to do, because I need to go a go back before we go into break. Because on Friday, I went into the promo, and I mentioned this historian that talked about Aristotle, talked about the Egyptians. His name was J.M. Roberts. And John Morris Roberts, he was born in 1928, and he died in 2003. He was a British historian, and with significant published works from 79 to 85. And so some of the stuff that he put in, you can tell, this is why I say, when you read this, you can tell this guy is telling you that we evolved from mice. I mean, he actually asserted that in his books. But look at when it was being written. He was like in the early wave of revisionist history. Durant was another one that kind of did that as well. I'm here to tell you, every author, when they editorialize history, unless they are doing an academic, so one of the better books for history that you need to read is by Alan and Swikert, and it is A Patriotic View of the American History from the Revolution or whatever. It's a big book, and I would highly recommend it because it's academically written. They actually cite their sources. Or it's far more academically written than J.M. Roberts. J.M. Roberts is literally editorializing. And so some of the things he points out, though, is really interesting. Why does he go out and point out this concept of this the Egyptian historians and so forth, or Aristotle? Why was he providing this? I think these were just outlier tidbits of information to show you how vast his knowledge on history really was. But I don't think he realized that when you look at what he was talking about with the Egyptians actually chronologized or basically documented the fact that the early faiths of the early societies was Christianity, or the makings of Christianity, because he talked about, you know, this poly-God society where there was a God that was a creator, there was a God that was a mediator, and there was a God that was, you know, a nurturer, a comforter, what have you. And that right there, these three God, that's the Godhead, right? The Trinity? And I think J.M. Roberts was completely, never went to a Christian church and was, you know, just told all of this hype or what have you. So he completely believed in evolution, and that's how he presented his history. So, you know, just a word to the wise, you can definitely see that this man is writing and revising history based on his biases. But for the most part, it's a very good read. Anyway, but you can tell I try not to necessarily read, you know, revisionist stuff, but sometimes you can actually garner a lot. This is why I actually try to keep an open mind. I even read Harlan Cleveland's promotion of the New World Order. I try to read the opposite. I've even read the Communist Manifesto. I've read Karl Marx and Engels' version of the Communist Manifesto. I even read Hitler's Mein Kampf. Sometimes you need to understand what these men were doing, these evil men were doing when they were laying their foundation to move forward. Because when you read what Hitler basically promoted in nationalism in Germany in his Mein Kampf, the first thing he was pointing to and he alluded to as he started rising to power is that the Republic needed to surrender its powers for centralizing the powers into a national government, because the Germanic state was a Republican form of government. Anyway, so let me move on and let me start getting back to where we were, because I was in the progress of exposing the truth about the 14th Amendment. And so I'm not going to necessarily go into editorializing, but let me just say this before I move forward, because I mentioned this gentleman by the name of L.C. Lyon, and that he wrote this article or this book about the day, you know, our nation was stolen or something like that. I don't know if it really matters, but the way I see it, this article and trying to find out who this author was, L.C. Lyons, was kind of hard to find. As a matter of fact, one of the things I found out was it might be a pseudonym, because I never found an L.C. Lyon ever, you know, so far in my searches. Now, I didn't spend a lot of time, you know, just a couple hours looking for who was using this document, kind of like a manifesto. And so one of the things I also noticed in common, the websites that actually reference this one document actually points to Anna von Ritz's, you know, fanatics and supporters type of sites. In other words, the sovereign citizen movement, this is like a source document for them. When you read that source document, I'm here to tell you folks that it is not what you really think. There's no citations. As a matter of fact, I only found a couple places where there were some quotes from source documents, but it still lacks citations. The article, again, actually, and this is how I searched for it, the day our country was stolen, just that. Then I added L.C. Lyon, and I found a couple of sites that cited that. But one of the things I also found was that one site posted it with byline by L.C. Lyon, but actually it pointed to somebody else's name. And so I'm doing the due diligence and looking, because one of these websites talks about common law out of Oregon. But all of these sites are sites that are basically telling you and giving you, they're bearing false witness or they're just lying. Remember, I believe that they've all embraced the lies coming from these other people of their editorials, and these stories seem to make sense to them. And so that's why they embrace it. They don't challenge it, they don't go and scrub the source documents, because anybody that starts but with the source documents, the ratification debates, and those types of things, because those things have been obscured, this is where we really get the truth. Most people have been reading the Federalist and Anti-Federalist papers, but I'm going to run out of time. I'll be right back after this promo. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so as I was going into this, so the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers had been published, and they had been actually documented and stored in archive, and they had been published and published and published and published. So that's one of those documents. What they talk about, these insights that they talk about, Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, those, you know, are not really subject to change until now. And what I mean by that is, because I've already warned you that artificial intelligence is going to be able to, and these doers of cover-ups and conspiracies and so forth, the people that actually do the things that the conspiracy theorists report and talk to you about, they're going to start doing deep fakes. They're going to start actually scrubbing, republishing, and eventually the Anti-Federalist and the Federalist Papers, I'm sure, are going to be touched and revised. The ratification debates probably are going to be just same thing with the Constitution. They have the ability. As a matter of fact, they've gotten to a point where the science of creating fake documents is getting so good. I remember there was a case in the 1980s where fake documents were actually coming out, where they took and they had to actually find specific paper that they could basically expose to heat and exposed to some chemicals and so forth, to where when you really looked at the paper and you closely examined it, closely, but not gone into the finite details of it. But when you look at the document, it was almost impossible to discern whether that document, almost impossible to discern whether that document was a legitimate document handwritten by somebody or not. The fakes and the attacks. This was in the 1980s, folks. And I'm telling you, science has gotten so much better in creating fraudulent papers. So you have to start questioning all of these different documents out there, especially if there's no corroborating evidence. Now, I'm saying this. Why? Because I've been given documents that are questionable, that assert that Alexander Hamilton was a spy. Also in the document pointed to George Washington as one of the top British spies. Now, because both of those names were on that sheet, I have a problem with it. I don't believe George Washington was really a British spy. I do believe that George Washington, I mean, at what point was he a British spy? Or there was not a lot of newspaper efforts regarding Benedict Arnold, other than the fact that Benedict Arnold actually left and sided with the British. And it was just known as a spy. And Washington treated him as a spy. And I have a hard time. I do not see a lot of corroborating evidence. Now, there's a lot of stories that go through that, you know, build upon his work in the Freemasons or the Mason sect or cult, whatever. And I do know that the monument that was built to him was not his design or by him. As a matter of fact, he, as well as Jefferson and all of the framers, did not want their faces on the money. They did not want to have any monuments. They did not want the American people to treat them as if they were gods. They realized that that would be the beginning of the downfall of this nation. So who was it that injected the ideas of creating all of these memorials? It was much later, right? But you can also tell that because Madison has no real memorial, I think that they really have done everything they can to downplay that man. Or I should say, if you look at the memorial they dubbed him with, which was a little plaque on the side of the Library of Congress. I mean, when you look at the person that was really more instrumental in the moving of this nation away from a monarchy and into a true free Republican form of government, into this Constitution, James Madison's the guy. And there was, you know, he had associations and help with Hamilton and a lot of other influencers, but he was the guy. And I'm going, hold on here. Why is it that, you know, he has been downplayed to this level? I mean, clearly he's been dubbed the father of the Constitution. And when I look at Abraham Lincoln and how he's been glorified, I honestly believe that these glorifications and these monuments and everything else, I believe that there's probably, if you do the research in that, that's where you'll probably find those people who started manipulating the American society at that point in time, with Thomas Jefferson, with George Washington, and so forth. But they did it in some honorable ways, and they probably tucked away some salacious lies that were all a part of all of this. I don't know, and I don't care. Why? Why? I'm spending a lot of time on today's show regarding stuff I really don't care about, other than the fact of trying to dispel or actually perform this political exorcism, that the 14th Amendment is a legitimate amendment, that the divine hand of providence was truly involved, and I see how it was involved in this. I mean, those men that wrote that, how brilliant was it to put Section 4 into this to basically state that any state that's a part of the Union is not responsible for any war debt regarding that rebellion from foreign nations, which basically forced those states to come back into the Union. How brilliant was that? That was brilliant. It actually, because what would have happened had those states actually not become a part of the Union? We would have had nothing but trouble. I mean, look at every other world states, from the Germanic states. I mean, look at Europe. It's a bunch of different states being divided amongst themselves, creating new states and so forth. So when we look at Section 3, I cannot see how we would be able to have any advantage today over our government. Without Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, we would not have the ability to actually slap these politicians with the papers of these petitions and so forth right between the eyes and say, look, you've taken an oath, you were legally obligated, and now if you don't take it, the supreme law of the land, because the 14th Amendment states that you are no longer eligible to be in office. So how important is the 14th Amendment just based on that one section? It is so instrumental. I mean, we can't succeed without it. That's how important it is. When we look at Section 2 and we look at the apportionment and how it actually delineates how apportionment is done by U.S. citizens only, it actually proves how the left has twisted and how the false witness bearers, the bearers of false witness from the Supreme Court have actually debased our Republican form of government and have converted it into a democracy. I mean, if you listen to some of the opinions in some of those cases that allow non-citizens to be apportioned and to receive benefits and to be here and go to school and taxpayer money, you would think that if they could have gotten away with it, they would have said, hey, America should be giving welfare and assuming everybody's a U.S. citizen as well as a world citizen. And that, you know, they all get due process in our court system. All you got to do is just come here. I mean, you can clearly tell that the globalist agenda was alive and well in all of those types of rulings. So as I go back to this Elsie Lyon, one of the things, like I said, I found a lot of sites that were using that document, that title, you know, how America was stolen or you know, whatever. There's no citations. And when you look at these websites, it's all a bunch of editorializing. It's not like they're providing you source documents. Going back to when I'm given artifacts, I mean, I was even given, and this is why I'm bringing it up, the Democratic Congressional Record of 1967. So here's the interesting thing that I like to throw out. You know, sometimes politics makes interesting bedfellows. Those people who want to pervert and ensure that we never figure out what we need to do, they seem to be saying the same thing. Now, this 1967 Democratic leadership, or I should say this little theatrical production in the House of Representatives, doesn't surprise me at all. But I am surprised that people considering themselves lovers of liberty and lovers of freedom who, you know, actually, you know, spew hate towards the Democrats and the communists and the globalist agenda, how they all agree that the 14th Amendment is the worst thing in the world. Does that not tip you off? Does that not show you how politics creates interesting bedfellows? Because they can't be in agreement and use the same support and arguments. In other words, they have to be coming from the same messenger. They're just having different spins on it. And this actually lends more to anybody realizing what it takes to actually, you know, conspire and to try to create controlled opposition and trying to actually move people down a designed path. This actually says to me, it is more of a testament of that than anything else. So one of the things I need to go into is the 14th Amendment. Now, the 14th Amendment, everybody said, and the Democrats said it was not constitutionally passed. And I'm here to tell you that it was passed. And if you also, and unfortunately, I will say this, I'm not a fan of Wikipedia because they always have their biases. But when it comes to some facts, you can actually find them a good factual source. I mean, I find it ironic that such a progressive rag, the progressive rag of Wikipedia, you know, has provided details regarding the Electoral College that actually helps prove how the parties started unifying in the 1850s and actually started stealing our Electoral College. I don't know the founders of Wikipedia. It's not like those guys have ever risen to, you know, prominence like Zucker, whatever, or these other big tech names that don't deserve the respect of pronouncing their names correctly, which is why I think, you know, it's I love Trump for that one little thing. He always comes up with really good insulting names of calling people that. But when I look at how the Civil War, and again, I said this on Friday, that the Civil War had, the Confederacy had 11 states, and the Union had 25. So the three-fourths rule is 17. In other words, for them to get 3/4 of these states to ratify, 17, for it to actually become a legitimate constitutional amendment. Now, when you look at the ratification of the 14th Amendment, without counting Tennessee, you'll find that we got 23 states that actually ratified it. And there's even this assertion that three states rescinded. Now, I'm not sure, because I've never done the due diligence. All I know, because I do know, in 2010, Delaware, because Biden was there, you know, as the vice president, Delaware is actually documented as ratifying it as of 2010, the 17th Amendment. Now, there were three states that never, or I should say, they ratified it and they rescinded it. And I think they actually went back to re-ratifying it as far as the 14th Amendment goes. When I look at those three states, the three states that actually did not ratify the 14th Amendment, it was Oregon, New Jersey, and Ohio. Or I should say, they ratified and they rescinded, right? So Tennessee, not even counting Tennessee, Tennessee at that point in time, I mean, there was more than enough. They had 19, actually, I think it was 20 total states that had ratified it. Even not taking Tennessee, it was still 19. So it still actually passed. They needed to actually prove to you and create a document that another state had rescinded it. But the question is, can a state rescind an amendment? And I don't believe it did. And as a matter of fact, I believe because of this recension and everything else, everybody was, you know, all of these questions were being thrown in, because one of the things that they were actually trying to do is they were trying to get new states into the union. So here's the other constitutional question, because the union was still growing at that time. When an amendment goes out to the union of the time, does that amendment go out to the South? No, because the South were not states at that time. So those state legislatures do not receive that amendment to ratify, because I've had this conversation with Keith Broders. When a new state comes in, and let's just say a new state that joined the union after that, and I've actually got that, the original order, so I can tell you, let's see, the first state that joined the union after the 17th Amendment would have been Nebraska and Colorado and so forth. So the question is, so let's just add Colorado. That's 1876. So Colorado, were they going to be held to ratifying the 14th Amendment? No, they didn't exist. They were a territory at the time the ratification went to the Union. Now, there is proof, by the way, there is actual proof that the original First Amendment was ratified, and this came out much later. As a matter of fact, there's a good story on this, that the reapportionment of the apportioning of representation, that First Amendment was actually ratified. And when they discovered this, they didn't tell anybody. They just said, oh, never mind. But the reality is, because Connecticut actually ratified it and they never reported it, what ended up happening was the state legislature actually ratified it. They voted and ratified it. And then they went and filed it. And whoever filed it, if this is not a part of the conspiracy, and oh, by the way, Dr. Johnson of Connecticut, who was a prominent politician in Connecticut, was considered a spy as well. And so he was definitely a part of the cabal of moving for a big government with Hamilton. But here's the point. That was misfiled into a folder, and it wasn't discovered until much later when somebody was looking at these documents. They go, oh my gosh, we did ratify that amendment. So technically, all the states have to do is say, hey, we want an audit of this, and boom, that amendment gets passed. Because it's already been proven that they actually just failed to file it with the federal government. Does that mean that the Constitution hadn't been ratified because they failed to just send it? when they actually did ratify it. It is basically an undoer, and it would, and the reason why this is being suppressed is it would unravel the 1929 Reapportionment Act, where Congress just assumed the power. Instead of having to amend the Constitution, they can just tell you how many people they will represent. You know, it'll be 2 million in a couple of years. That's what they're doing, because they feel they get away with that. And we went through this, as a matter of fact, just the past reading of Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, that they were not to have that type of control, or they would start manipulating. And that was very clear. These men understood that. That's why it had to be amended. Anyway, so back to the 14th Amendment. It actually ratified. Even without Tennessee and without those recensions, like they legitimately rescinded, we still had the 19 states. I believe it was 20, but I might be wrong. But we still had the 20 states. And I believe that that's one of the reasons why it was passed. And as soon as it got passed, as soon as it was finally confirmed, there were already factions in the political venue that were already forming and how to redefine it, because some of the first things that was being redefined was the equal protection under the law. Go read, and this is in Why Counties Matter Most, how that was actually defined. It was defined regarding criminal behavior so that they couldn't persecute people, not ideological behavior, not this ideological comment of actually being able to create equality in all things. It was all about protection under the law from being able to be persecuted because you were black. So, like separate but equal, that was basically a reinterpretation of that line. And it continued all these different perverse twistings of the 14th Amendment. So why do you think, and go look at the history of all of the times the Supreme Court has worked and chewed on redefining the 14th Amendment. Why? Because it was a problem to them. Because it's a problem even to the states today. Because no state can make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen. This goes back to a candidate conversation. I had a conversation. It was a text. I sent a text to a gentleman who was a candidate and asked that gentleman, could a proprietor or a business within a state dictate that you can't bring guns onto the premises of this facility that they have, whether it's a medical facility, a bar, or what have you? Can they actually make a law that the state would have to enforce to say you're a criminal because you brought a gun where you can't have a gun? Because there's nowhere in the Constitution that has changed the Second Amendment that the right of bearing arms shall not be infringed. So even though you may not like it, the problem is that we have this paradigm that people having guns are criminals, and only cops that have guns are good guys. When we realized that the Constitution created a militia system of a people self-governing, that all people had guns, and that we have to go back to that to actually fix the problems that we have. In other words, go watch those old movies of the West. I mean, people carried guns everywhere, even into court. Because when we knew that people could defend themselves at any point in time, other than the defendant who was arrested, once you've been charged with a crime and you're actually arrested, then they actually have this ability to strip you until you've had your due process. Now, this is why the Eighth Amendment, no excessive bail should ever be submitted. But we've, as a society, we've allowed them to manage who the Bar Association is managing our Eighth Amendment, which is why we have really unfair bail and so forth. But this show's not all about that. So the 14th Amendment, there's no there. The 14th Amendment was not improperly passed, nor did it create any citizenship of subjugation that everybody wants to tell you. As a matter of fact, open up a constitution. Look up the word citizen. I dare you to look up the word citizen. You'll find citizen of the United States to be in Article 1, Section 2. Article 1, Section 2. You'll also find it in Article 1, Section 3. You'll also find it in Article 2, Section 1. You'll also find it in Article 3. You'll also find it in Article 4. Because in Article 4, it says the citizens of each state shall be entitled to the privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states, because they were citizens of the United States. And actually, when you look at Article 1, Section 8, the federal government created the jurisdiction over all crimes that were committed against the laws of nations and the laws of piracies on the high seas, the crimes and piracies committed on the high seas. In other words, if another nation took an American, a U.S. citizen, the United States claimed jurisdiction so that they could actually invoke their jurisdictional rights to protect you and pull you back from being impressed or being thrown in jail or being hanged. They claim full jurisdiction over all Americans traveling abroad. So how is it that they actually didn't create the U.S. citizen under the original Constitution? Is anybody that tells you that that didn't happen, then it happened under the 14th Amendment, they're not bearing the truth, they're bearing false witness, or they're lying from basically the education that they've been taught. The U.S. citizen was actually created well before that. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that they actually started doing was they started actually delineating that you had to be a U.S. citizen to be represented right here in the original Constitution to be a senator or a representative. Did you understand what I just said? To be the president or to be anybody involved in the government, you had to be a U.S. citizen. Now, did they go through and create paperwork and they create identification and use capital letters and all of these, these things that I'll just say these soothsayers are telling you are evil? If capital letters do not make you, do not change who you are. They may be using it as a sub-reference that is all outside their authority to use those types of things and cataloging you. The Social Security number, they don't have the authority to do that. They don't have the authority to even run the Social Security Administration. It needs to be shut down. You know why these sovereign citizen movements don't even bring that up? Because there'd be a lot of people who'd be upset about that. They first got to convince you to come in the door, and then they got to convince you to get out so you don't have to pay taxes anymore. And then you just become an inhabitant and no longer a citizen. And I'm telling you, folks, these people are the great deceivers, because you no longer are a citizen where you have protections of due process, trial by jury. All of those things are off the table. You remove yourself from being a U.S. citizen. You have no rights under the law. Now, you're still a child of God, and you can call down upon God to protect your rights, but we actually create governments. We institute governments, and we instituted one where the law is king. All of these things that they're doing is unconstitutional, not founded on the law, and the 14th Amendment is legitimate law. Next time on Friday, we'll go into the 16th and 17th Amendment. I'm G.R. Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.